Would you?
My question.
Yes.
I find it difficult. I find it a contradiction to talk about impersonal love.
Jeffrey says he finds it difficult to conceive of impersonal love. Any remarks?
One can feel if you're walking with nature, with no people, one feels a love there. I would call it love, which is unconnected with people. In fact, the less people are there, the more you feel the love. That's when I really do feel love, a creative love. Sometimes I just talk to the clouds and the trees and sort of feel connected to that.
A lot harder to love other people, I find. I find that is what we're talking about, isn't it? How can we love other people without demanding or trying to influence them in a sense? And that is extremely difficult.
That's why I mentioned that pure love is undemanding and unpossessive.
Mm. It's easy to do that with the clouds and the trees because you can't possess them anyway, but we think we can possess people. We try.
Yes.
Or they've tried to possess us, which is sometimes even more horrific.
Yes, you can feel the vibrations when people are walking even past you. Yeah. You can feel vibrations.
Not usually of love, either.
No.
This sort of impersonal love is the sort of love that the perfected holy ones had for all mankind, and not only for mankind, but for the plant world and the animal world also. And it was through that sort of love, combined with their perceptive powers into the psyche and the general nature of any human being, which enables them to give the right sort of teaching to each person individually. Because after all, it's a little bit like this. There's no sense in trying to teach differential calculus to a 4-year-old in the kindergarten. Can't be done. So you have to teach him what is valuable for him. And you cannot teach what is valuable for him unless you perceive what he is. And then you know that this person is such and such a nature, such and such abilities, disabilities, and so forth. And you give the right sort of teaching in accordance with that. In order to perceive the person who needs help, one has to be impersonal, especially in the sense that one is selfless in relation to that particular person, and is free from his own conditioning. Because all people, perfected holy ones included, are conditioned people in some degree or other. One of the major values of meditation in the true sense, in the great sense, and in the deep sense, is that it enables us to become free by understanding, clearly understanding our own conditioning and how it came about and how it has affected us. That way we can understand the other person, as we call him. Because when you have the state of being the perfected Holy One, you understand the truth about any person. If you have heard any gossip in relation to that person, you can put it aside, because a great deal of quarrel and misunderstanding takes place through gossip. I think all the religious disciplines tell us to avoid gossiping about anybody or anything. Even with respect to the so-called good qualities. I mean by that a person's good qualities have not yet, in all probability, developed to their full fruition. That is why there are grades and grades. How truthful is a person? How kind is he? And so on and so on, you see. We are all at different stages with respect to our virtues. And virtue in its consummation, in its true richness, is something which we do not normally know. So there are all these problems involved. But when you've got the right situation, then impersonal love functions quite freely. You know how parents, teachers, friends want you to be thus and thus and thus, as they think you ought to be. They forget that actually, through the evolutionary process, each single person of all the 5,000 millions who populate the globe, each one of them is unique, truly unique, and therefore needs a unique and whole relationship with the person who is trying to help him. Now, people like Jesus, the Buddha, and the great teachers had that ability. They were able to form the right relationship. And in that right relationship, they also knew more about themselves. It sounds strange to say that the Buddha, after his enlightenment, also learned more about himself in trying to help others. I think the philosophical reason for that is just this. The perfected Holy One can function in the context of the infinite and the eternal, which is the divine context. He is free from the limitations imposed upon him by the usual finite and temporal and therefore mortal context. But he, being able to function in the immortal context, is able to see, penetrate into the truth of the other person as such, exactly what he is, and therefore he gives him the right sort of help and teaching. And that invariably necessitates this impersonality, which is not indifference. You know, for instance, how the Buddha mentions metta, karuna, mudita, and upekkha as the culminating point of love. Now, the literal, ordinary meaning of upekkha is indifference. Now, you cannot relate indifference with love in any sense. But what can be a deep meaning of this word upekkha? I would suggest it is dispassionate observation. And dispassionate observation means observation which is free of one's own conditioning. You will notice in the Vinaya Pitaka, 5 volumes of them, that when some monk has been rather a naughty boy or something like that, you see, he doesn't spare his criticisms. For instance, take the commonest misbehavior on the part of the monks, any sort of sexual indulgence. And he says outright, it would be better if your male member were in red hot charcoal than that you should have done such a thing. That's how he puts it. It sounds frightfully cruel. But the cruelty is not in a feeling in the Buddha himself about it. And the cruelty, it sounds cruel to us because it is an incredibly painful thing. But I can imagine the Buddha saying the most terrible things in a gentle voice, in a gentle manner, and at the same time emanating from his own being that kind of understanding and love and compassion which enables the person to hear these things and really enter into the true meaning of them. Because after all, without sexual love, there would be no Buddhas or Christs or anything like that. One has to be very sensible and matter of fact. I mention sex simply because it has been one of the most powerful influences in the whole of the evolutionary process. Sex where humans are concerned, animals are concerned, and so on. But it has been called a sin. Now, can a person sin beautifully and happily? Now think of it. Look into it carefully. How do you sin beautifully and happily? If you can do so, is it a sin anymore? Because beauty is one of the hallmarks of truth and goodness. And you see, this criticism of sex has, and the antagonism towards sex has been responsible for so much illness in so many human beings. Therefore, if we want to help a person in a difficult situation where the sexual aspect of life is concerned, we ourselves must be free of criticism. When a Buddha pronounces these terrible things, it is not as a criticism, you're a dirty dog or anything like that. There isn't that feeling in the perfected Holy One. And that is due to the fact that he has this dispassionate observation, upekkha, well developed within himself. There are so many aspects to it. And it's most interesting that it is only in Buddhism that you find upekkha, this dispassionate observation, coupled with the idea of love. And that is impersonal love. At least so it seems to me. I may be wrong. What do you think?
Should a monk or person who has taken a particular goal, all right, for the time being, goal, he should have a discipline. So all these are drawbacks maybe for him.
Yes, but remember that discipline is not repression or suppression. You see, whatever is done by way of repression and suppression leads to illness and imbalance in the mind. And that doesn't help the true fruition of a human being. Because you have heard me say this before again and again. The word human, what does it mean? Blissful creator. You find in Sanskrit, su manas, su gata, words like that. The prefix su in Sanskrit, which is interchangeable with the Avastan hu, hu. Now we in the English language have the Avastan form, hu, preceding the man, man. What is man? Your dictionaries will tell you that man, the root man, means to think. But thinking is a petty little affair. Insight is something very, very different from just thinking. We think according to our conditioning, but we have insight according to the flowering of our innermost consciousness. You see? And this root man finds perhaps one of the very significant explanations in the Trismegistic writings, where it is said that God is referred to as All Father Mind. Then, having created this, that, and the other, All Father Mind brought into being man and fell in love with him as his only child. This idea that we humans are the children of God comes from the Trismegistic writings. And the Trismegistic writings are the Hellenistic form in which those old thinkers is a bad word, but those old seers interpreted the word man. And man is created by the power of the word. So man rarely represents the blissful, the hu part is the blissful part, and the man part is the creative part. Because it is the word from which everything comes into being. And it is also called the thought in the mind of God. But God doesn't think at all. You know, Descartes said, cogito or cogito, I think the Latin is a hard G. Cogito ergo sum. I think, therefore I am. If God spoke in the Latin language, he would say, creo ergo sum. I create, therefore I am. It's a very different thing. Mm. So when we read in St. John's Gospel, in the St. John lets out a good deal of the secret in those few lines. he says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, and the Word was with God. Now no man can define God. God is the unknown and unknowable. And so in Christian theologies, God is referred to not only as the unknown, but the unknowable. And our knowledge of God is derived from our knowledge of Jesus and so forth. But knowledge is a very limited thing. And often it is a hindrance. Often it is a hindrance. It prevents insight. Actually prevents insight. It promotes insight only when we are able to drop all our prejudices, our preconceptions, our assumptions, and even our natural bias. Our natural bias is a gift, is the gift of evolution. Because you take phenomena like Mozart composing at the age of 6 and so on. You see, that is a bias. He had a bias that way, inborn. He was genetically programmed that way. And that's the bias. So we also have the faulty side of bias. He is biased in favor of this, that or the other, as against that, this or the other. So you see, in order to be free from that inner conflict within ourselves, we have to observe dispassionately, which is very important. Impersonal love. Demanding nothing, possessing nothing, inflicting nothing, not even inflicting joy. Because if you inflict joy upon the person you love, you get more and more tied to that. And you tie the other person also at the same time. So that it ends up by being a demanding and a possessing love. That's my wife. Don't you dare touch her. You see? And so forth. No, I think I've chattered enough. Of course, to carry out the idea of wisdom being observation of anything and everything without exception, observation which is free of approval, disapproval, attachment, or aversion. All this is part of yoga also at the same time. One must remember that. I think the books which we have on yoga produced in modern times need to go through a good deal of growing pains before they become efficient books, helpful books. You notice they confine themselves, certainly in outside Asian countries, to the asanas, the postures, and pranayama, the breathing techniques. You see, the asanas and pranayama by themselves lead to psychic powers. And unless one is already sufficiently developed with the yamas and niyamas, that is the moralities, the virtues, and the religious observances. It's a long story, so I won't go into that right now, the religious observances. Unless there is that basis, so to say, the psychic powers invariably get misused. We have heard of some, I'm sorry to say, Indian self-appointed gurus who are wealthy beyond dreams, and wealth beyond dreams means personal power and so on.
Is that grounding also a part of the necessity to... Do you also need that grounding for us to be able to love dispassionately?
Yes. Yes. You see, the actual techniques which are practiced in yoga, I'm referring just to asanas and pranayama, they themselves promote the virtues. Because, for one thing, they discipline the body, discipline in the right way, without any suppression or repression. They discipline the body to be a fit instrument to stand the strain of spiritual development. It's a little bit like this. If you have an electric bulb which can take a 60 volt current, it's no good giving it a 500 volt current. The bulb will burst. Indian friends of some British officers during the last previous century have taken them to see how a person sitting in meditation under a tree is actually dead because the body couldn't stand the strain of it. You see, one mustn't play with power. See what happened historically in the case of all those who played with power. Take Alexander the Great, for example. Take Napoleon. Take Hitler. You see, it is invariably misused. And in the spiritual realm, what happens is that one deliberately destroys oneself. And that doesn't take you far. Excepting under the soil. Or to the crematorium, as the case may be. No, this wisdom and love are profound things altogether. So profound that mere thinking, mere studying will not bring about salvation. Selflessness is perhaps one of the basic words whose meaning, if properly understood, will promote salvation of the individual in the true sense. And insofar as it promotes the salvation of the individual, it promotes the salvation of all mankind. Because, you see, we are so imprisoned in this idea of, oh, John Smith is the other fellow, or Edward Jones is the other fellow. This idea of otherness is a mistaken idea. There is nothing which is other. Everything throughout the cosmos, throughout the entire field of manifestation, is interrelated and interactive. It rests with us human beings to understand this. Animals can't understand it. They more or less instinctively do what they do in relationship to other animals. The tiger which springs upon the antelope or something. That's instinct at work, because it has to feed itself. And it is only with the arrival of humanity on the world stage that we have anything like the virtues which we talk about and think about. Of course, there are, I said earlier, if you sin, that is to say, consider what sin being doing something which is considered by other people, by people, that this is a sin, you see. If you sin beautifully and happily, you've harmed nobody. What is the meaning of the word sin? Its fundamental meaning, especially in its German form, is whatever hurts, spoils, or upsets the unity of the universe. The universe is a universe which is a cosmos. This is where the Greeks were so right. Order, something which is order, harmony. The very word universe means turned into a unity, which is its origin. Yes, please do discuss these things, you see, and remember that discussion is not argumentation. In argumentation, A tries to convince B that he is right in the matter and B is wrong, and vice versa. You see. That's argumentation. But discussion is presenting your understanding of the matter freely, generously to others, as we say. See, these two things, wisdom and love, lead to the perfect fruition of humankind. And such a person can be a blissful creator.
Thérèse, if we choose...
Speak up.
If we choose some to be our friends and exclude other people, are we then inhibiting our path to understanding?
What do you think yourself?
Yes, I mean,
I think so.
But so many of us do it, don't we? We choose to know some person.
See, this business of exclusiveness contradicts the fact of the whole cosmos. How can you have a cosmos which is complete order if there is any exclusion? You see? At the same time, the inclusion must not be just indiscriminate acceptance, because there are things which are wrong. For instance, bodily, speaking bodily. When a person has a headache or a bellyache or whatever it is, there is something which is out of order, isn't it? It's like that. And so the right sort of medicine has to be applied. And where the psychophysical, the psychical part of the psychophysical organism is concerned, that order is restored through what we call the virtues. We think, we imagine that we understand the meaning of the virtues, but we don't. I think in the heart of religion, I have called virtue soul strength. Now the body can't be strong if it is ill. It is strong, it can be strong if it is well and functioning harmoniously. So virtue is soul strength, from vir, the Latin vir, viris, genitive case, meaning a man. And a man being a psychophysical organism, you see, has virtue as the basis for his psychical strength and perfection.
When you speak of children of new dawn, are you saying there is a burst of consciousness now? We're 10 years off the millennium. That is happening at this period in history, or is it a term you're using for people who are on a path, on a spiritual path in general, that happened perhaps 100 years ago as well, or is it going on? It's not just now.
It's not just now. There always has been, through the millennia of human history, the what we call the good, what we call the evil. After all, what is a simple meaning of the word evil? That which is painful, hurtful to me, which I dislike, I call evil. If interest rates go up, somebody will say, oh, how terrible, how awful. And others will say, oh, excellent, I'll have more money now. What is good, what is evil? And you know the statement, what is truth, said jesting Pilate. What is truth? The truth we shall never know during our lifetime. Or even if we had several lifetimes, we will never know. Because in the state of holiness, of completeness, of final fruition, so in the which occurs in the context of the infinite and the eternal, there is always a beyond. If there is no beyond, you have contradicted the significance and meaning of infinite and eternal. You see, the sort of rules of morality and the doctrines laid down right up to almost our own century have been laid down with an eye to social order and social control, so that you had a kingdom or a state which was a harmonious or more or less harmonious state. And the idea of sanctions, punishment, actually is a confession of failure on my part to love, to educate, and to heal. This is very important. See, that is why punishment doesn't produce an ultimate good. Ultimately doesn't produce good. it raises up a revenge feeling in the person punished. Look at this Manchester prisoner. Look at the destructiveness which has taken place in consequence. No, the only way is the way of love and wisdom. And that produces beauty and goodness, which is indestructible goodness. So when the Buddha met Angulimala, Angulimala was not conquered by the Buddha. He was won over, you see, which is a very different thing. Contrast with that sort of event and outlook with the Treaty of Versailles after the First World War. Squeeze the orange till the pips, it just doesn't do the trick. It's a mistaken idea. I remember so well several of my Cambridge friends with the Second World War. Oh, we must just split up Germany into tiny little bits so that she can never rise again and make a nuisance of herself and so on. But what nonsense! Look at the nuisance we have made of ourselves. The Anglo-Saxons have, when they have gone abroad. Curiously enough, where Central America, Mexico and Peru and such places are concerned, the Anglo-Saxons have been the worst for destructive dreams. And the Jesuit, please, have been responsible for winning over the people. There is a church, I think, in Mexico where there are four statues. One of the Virgin, one of Plato, one of the Buddha in a Christian church, and one of, I forget his name, a Spaniard. Now those Jesuits had a good deal of sense there, whereas take the, by contrast, Captain Cook. He bought a lot of flags, whichever island he discovered, he planted the flag, said, "That is ours now." A very highly successful highway robber. Well, isn't it highway robbery? I can tell you a true story. Well, Captain Cook is also true. One of Sylvia's closest friends was the daughter of Professor Roberts of Cardiff. He was an economist and a historian. And Sylvia saw his daughter for the first time when Sylvia was 6 months old and the young girl was just a few days old. The girl, Miriam, that was her name, she grew up to be a very intelligent child, ended up ultimately as headmistress of her own school, you see, and that sort of. Now, one day, Miriam came home from school saying, "Daddy, Daddy, our history teacher told us today that the European powers carved up the whole continent of Africa amongst themselves without a shot being fired." And dear Professor Roberts said to Miriam, "And what business had they to?" Mm. you see.
We have a lot of conditioning to overcome.
I beg your pardon?
We have a lot of conditioning to overcome, as Anglo-Saxons.
We are born with possessiveness.
Is it the trend, is it not the trend throughout the history of mankind?
Pardon?
This is the trend of any powerful, anybody, any society which becomes powerful, they behave like that.
Mm. And if you read Machiavelli, or if you read Kautilya's Arthashastra, you will see it emphasized that one of the main businesses of the ruler of any country is to expand his territories.
Raj Chakravarti.
By conquest.
Yes.
You see. Well, what does conquest do? It brings sorrow and trouble to millions of people. Just think of Ashoka's conversion to Buddhism. His grandfather was a Jain, and his father also, presumably. And he was born as a Jain. But after the Kalinga War, in which 100,000 were slain, 150,000 were seriously wounded and all that sort of thing, it so affected the Emperor Ashoka, who was ruler of a vast India, much vaster than what it is today. It included what is Pakistan today, bits of southern, the southern USSR, right up to the highlands of Herat in Afghanistan, and so forth. Well, Ashoka was so strongly affected by all this human suffering that he turned to Buddhism and the doctrine of compassion and wisdom of the Buddha. He was the person who had established the first animal hospitals in India. What was Ashoka's date? 276 to 232 BC, something like that. But Ashoka's own son and grandson, they weren't worthy of their origins. They imprisoned Ashoka, practically starved him to death. That is what the human race is like still. Do you wonder that I refer to it as human?
I went to the Red Fort in Delhi, and the Mughal emperors made this beautiful Red Fort, and then it was completely tricked out of their hands. The last Mughal emperor apparently received a visitor who tricked him and invaded it and destroyed all the jewels and silver in the temple, and now it's just a husk.
Aurangzeb was the last emperor, Mughal emperor.
Right. But it's now an empty shell compared to what it was.
It's strange that it's the members of the human race who have also produced the most marvelous art and philosophy that there is in the world today. Look at Chinese history. Like Islamic history, it's written in red, written in blood. And China has produced some of the finest art and philosophy in the world. It's curious how these things go together. But again, when we see our flaws, our murderousness, our thievishness, and so on. When we see all that, we mustn't condemn the self or condemn anybody else who is like that, see, or fight against it. What you fight against often strengthens the other person.
We're all opposites, aren't we? So our own weakness, we have to accept our weakness in order to be develop our strength.
Exactly. How often a person wishes his uncle or whoever it is dead because there's a great legacy to come of him.
And how often the person dies and the person receiving the legacy is left with an enormous feeling of guilt.
Yes, yes.
So what's the point?
Observe carefully and observe with an understanding heart. Don't observe with the brain merely. The brain is the repository of a lot of trouble. And then one can use the brain in the right way. Because after all, the brain is the instrument of mind. The scientists, until our own century, all thought of the brain and the mind being identical. That is not so. Mind is the formative power of the primordial creative energy. You see, the primordial creative energy, God, Brahman, use what word you like, is shapeless and formless, and as the Hindus have put it, desiring to know itself, this shapeless and formless creative energy manifested this, that and the other, and it had to manifest it all in terms of harmony and beauty. Otherwise the manifestation perishes. The brain deals with the mechanism of existence. The mind deals with revelation. And revelation is wordless and thoughtless. Not thoughtless in the meaning of careless, but thoughtless meaning without thought. Because thought is the result of some external stimulus, a sensory stimulus, usually. You see. But mind deals with revelation as such. Revelation being the true nature of whatever you are experiencing or observing, and so on.